Welcome to this episode of Saintly Witnesses, where I speak to Catholics across social media who are doing great things. On this particular episode, I have Emily Strand on. Last time she came, she was with her co-host Eric Styles, and they both host the fabulous podcast called Meet Father Rivers, which just explores the ins and outs of their personal relationship and legacy of former deceased priest Father Clarence Joseph Rivers. So thank Emily for coming on again this time to talk a little bit about her music career and some of her cultural passions.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here. Glad we ditched that Eric Styles. Ugh. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
No, that's your partner in crime. So
That is my partner in crime. He is, yes, definitely.
for sure, for sure. So my first question, I haven't asked in a while, but I'm eager to know your faith journey. So are you a revert, convert, or a cradle Catholic? And give us some like a big picture overview of your faith journey, how it was growing up, middle life, and it kind of led you into now.
Definitely. So I am a cradle Catholic. I come from a big Catholic family, youngest of five kids. My dad was actually a convert, though. He converted in the 1950s. And the Catholic Church was really kind of exciting and progressive, in the 1950s to a lot of people, especially outsiders. And we were doing a lot of things. We had a lot of stuff going on. And my dad said that he was kind of a little bit lost in life. He didn't quite know what path he needed to be on, and he was working at a gas station, and he and the guys that would work on Sunday afternoons would talk about where they went to church that morning and what the message was. And he said that the guy who was Catholic, everybody was kind of from a different tradition. He said the guy who was Catholic always had the best things to say. And so I love that story because it's like a story about sort of unwitting evangelization, right? This guy was just joining in the conversation, but my dad really was attracted to the message that the guy was conveying. So he became Catholic, and in the 1950s, and then he met my mom, who had been a cradle Catholic. They're both from families, especially my dad, who hadn't been long in the country. My grandparents were Scandinavian immigrants, and my mom's family was a little bit more established, but there weren't very many Catholics in their part of Ohio when they were growing up. So they were definitely a minority, and they experienced, some of the nativist Catholic prejudice of the time and everything. So, but the thing about my parents, the reason I go on and on about them is because they showed me just the absolute very best version of Catholicism you could possibly offer a young person. They loved being Catholic. They were super active in our parish, which was, just 3 miles up the street from our house. And they did all the things. They, did the liturgical ministries. They served on the parish council, and it was hard to get out of church on Sunday afternoons. It was like, come on, mom, stop talking, And all five of us, we didn't know what it meant to skip church. We didn't know that was an option. And we went to church on vacation. That was always very interesting. You got to go to a different church, different Catholic church, of course. So my parents were a huge, huge part of my experience of what Catholicism means to me, and it's always been very important to me and very special to me. So, then, when I was a young person, I went to public school K through 8 and Catholic girls' high school in Cincinnati, of which there are many. And I had a pretty good experience, but I wasn't on any kind of track to pursue ministry or theology as a topic. I didn't even know it was much of a topic. I was kind of like, church is just something you do on Sundays, and then you go about your way. But I had when I went to college at the University of Evansville, which is not a Catholic college, it's a Methodist university, but I was involved in our campus Newman Center, and I went on a couple of retreats at St. Meinrad in southern Indiana, which is a Benedictine monastery, huge, beautiful place. And I had, I mean, really what I can only classify as mystical, a couple mystical experiences. So in the first one, I felt really called to ministry, and especially ministry with regard to the sacraments, which was somewhat confusing for a young woman. But I have spent my life trying to fulfill that call and to lead other people to the sacraments, and especially to a greater experience and more meaningful experience of the sacraments. So, and then I would also say my faith journey was very much shaped by my graduate work at the University of Dayton. Dayton is a great place, is a wonderful community spirit there. And we, you know, yeah, I was surrounded by people of faith who took that faith seriously enough to want to investigate it theologically, historically, you know, systematically, right? So I really had a lot of wonderful mentors there that helped me to grow in my faith and not just my knowledge. So it was certainly formation as much as it was information. And then, you know, to round out my answer here, I would say the greatest, probably besides my parents, the greatest influencer on my life and my Catholicism was my lifelong participation in the liturgy, especially as a liturgical minister from a young age. You know, I probably started lecturing and cantoring when I was 13, 14, started accompanying when I was 12. And I just always participated in the liturgy, and that formed and shaped who I was, and every part of it. You know, we always were dragged to the Triduum every year. You know, come on, kids, right? My parents had probably had to take many years off of going to it because we were so little. But then once I came along, they were like, oh, you'll sleep later. You know, you can sleep when you're dead. Just get in the car, you know? So all of those experiences really added up to just feeling very rooted to my faith and to the church, especially through the liturgy.
Okay. And you had a lot of significant moments too, it sounds like, from early life, and you had a well-rounded, strong family of Catholics that influence you and impart the faith on you. And that has lasted since childhood. So that's a remarkable thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm very lucky, very lucky.
That is a good thing to be lucky about and grateful for too. So from what I understand, and you touched on this last time when we were discussing the Meet Rivers podcast, and you were discussing Father Clarence Rivers, that you kind of was in a music career from some point. And I think it's fascinating because I have so much love for singer-songwriters from the 70s and until now.
Same.
So talk a little bit about your career as a musician, and what influenced you to take that journey?
Well, I come from a musical background. So my mom was a jazz singer from when she was in high school in the 1950s through when, you know, until really she got married and started, you know, yeah, pretty much marriage ended her career, but that was okay. She was ready to give it up because she got married a little bit late in life. So, but she played, she was a singer, a lead singer, and she played the upright bass. And so she played with a lot of different jazz combos and big bands in the Cincinnati and Dayton areas in throughout the mid-1950s to the mid-1960s. And so she played with John Escosa. She played with a lot of different names. She played a lot of the clubs that you know, people know about. Once in a while, she still gets somebody who's like, we used to go and hear you at the blah, 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 you know, and it's like, she's kind of famous. She's kind of a big deal. But her mother was a great pianist and a great harpist and a great musician. She, when she was a young woman, she played piano for the silent movies. And then her father was apparently a one-man band. And so I come from this long line of people who found, you know, music was in their blood, and they were able to, you know, support themselves to some degree with it. So songwriting, when you said songwriters from the 70s, yes, love them. James Taylor, Joni Mitchell, you know, so many, Jackson Browne, so many wonderful songwriters, Neil Young, all of those people, you know, later the Indigo Girls, I mean, all of those, all of that genre, you know, of kind of songwriter really spoke to me as a young person. And you know, I mean, we tend to make, I mean, some of us, at least I do, tend to make art out of pain, you know, so once my childhood kind of became adolescence and I started, you know, in adolescence, you really feel the hurts of life, you know, more than you ever did. And so I started making songs, you know, about them, and people seemed to like them, so I carried on. I learned to play the guitar. I'd long been a pianist, but I learned to play the guitar, which seemed a lot more practical in terms of carrying it around with me, and took it with me to University of Evansville and made a lot of musical connections there. Ended up in a couple of bands. We played like top 40 at clubs, and so but we always kind of fitted in my original songs because they seemed to think they were good. And so I ended up releasing an album titled Evansville in like 1999, I want to say. And then I did another one that I recorded in Nashville. I ended up gravitating to Nashville and hanging out down there for a couple years, kind of trying to see if I wanted to try to write commercially. I end up wanting to do that. My songwriting is very instinctual and kind of inspiration. I mean, it's very inspired. It's not like I never sat down to write a song. It was always some song kind of grabbed me, and I had to go and let it out, you know. So I ended up recording another album in Nashville, and then one more in Cincinnati with a band that I played with in Cincinnati called The Town, who I still collaborate with occasionally. But yeah, it was a great career. I have so many memorable experiences that it's hard to recall them, but I especially the friendships, all the friendships involved, you know, I still cherish those friendships. But you know, one big really two big contests that were wonderful because I won were the we had a radio station, alternative radio station called WOXY. I'm sorry, no, that is not, yeah, WOXY. I think it was 97X. It was 97X. It was a kind of a historic alternative rock radio station. They did a contest every year, the area's best unsigned band, and our band, The Town, won that in 2003. And then in 2004, this was really special. I submitted to and won in the category of folk a John Lennon Songwriting Award for my song "Lou," which you know was kind of a whim submission on my part. I was just like, well, let's fling this to the ether and see what happens. And lo and behold, I won. And it was crazy because the judges were like Elton John and Bootsy Collins and like, you know, I mean, it just insane. You know, I was like, I can't believe these people heard my song and voted for it, you know, got behind it. So it was a really felt it was such a wonderful affirmation because it is hard. You know, life as a musician is hard, especially leading a band, trying to organize all that, trying to pursue other interests. I've always had many interests, so sometimes you don't get the respect that you feel like you really want. And that award seemed to heal a lot of wounds in my career. So I always say I don't play music anymore, but I still stand behind my music. It was good. It just you know, I kind of moved on to other things eventually.
Out of curiosity, as you were sharing about your music career, around the early thousands, if I can recall, that's the time when you got acquainted with Eric and Father Clarence, right?
So actually, I got acquainted with Father Clarence then, but I did not meet Eric until 2020.
Right. I'm sorry. That's
Right,
correct.
right. We heard
So,
about each other, but we
right,
didn't actually meet. Yeah.
that's correct. So you knew Father Clarence at the time. So
I
out of
did.
curiosity, did y'all like have a mutual understanding of like music and musicology and artists? Did y'all have like enriching conversations?
That is a fabulous question because absolutely yes. I was so thick into my music career at the time. When I arrived, because I came to the University of Dayton for graduate school in 2001, and I came straight from Nashville, and I was so into my career. I was really still trying to make it work as a songwriter. I was hoping to do more touring and to get, you know, all that stuff. I was really pursuing it hot and heavy. And I told them at the University of Dayton, I said, listen, this is great. I want to do this grad program, but I have to have time for my career. I even sent them my album, you know, when I applied, and they listened to it. They liked it. You know, they thought, well, this is kind of interesting, you know. But yeah, so when I showed up, you know, to talk to Father Rivers, it was, you know, it was as a young person who's pursuing graduate studies at the same time I was pursuing a career as a professional, you know, singer-songwriter. And I told Father Rivers that. And we definitely connected on an artistic level. We definitely had that kind of aesthetic concern. And he even said he wrote a letter to me that I read on the podcast, I think in episode 3 or 4. And he said he recognized in me somebody who has an aesthetic sense that leads me to conclusions beyond the aesthetic. And that's just him as well. I mean, that's, and so we really had that kind of bond. And I sent him a copy of my album. Also, when I sent him the first paper I wrote about him, I sent him the paper and I sent him my album, and he called me. I think that's the one and only time he called me. He called me and he said, "Oh, I like that. That song," because I had some kind of vaguely, you know, feminist sort of songs on my album, and he said, "Oh, you just told him all to F off." I have censored myself. I have censored Father Rivers for the purpose of your podcast, but yes, he was very interested in not only art for art's sake, but art for the sake of social change. And so he identified with that as well. So yeah, great question. He was a supporter.
Hey, that's good to know. I was naturally happened to think about that because I was like, just channeling back to events. So that's good to know.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask this question, but I'm going to say this first. And it's kind of funny, but my wife and I, some years ago, we were like, "Hey, we get all these Harry Potter films in like the little box sets," and we bought them all from Half Price Bookstore. We've watched like the first two, so we are guilty of not finishing the series.
Right. Wow. Okay. Up your alley.
Yeah. We're like 5 years behind, but things have happened in life and all that stuff. Which leads me to my next question. Or like instrumental in the book Pottersversity, essays exploring the world of Harry Potter. What is it, and why is Harry Potter something that's so important that you feel like you had to hop on and discuss on so many topics that are relatable in our world? Because Harry Potter has that sort of appeal that touches on multiple different areas.
It does. It brings a lot of different disciplines together in terms of academic interests and things like that. The author, I don't, you know, she just must be very variously interested in many different things. But, first of all, I'll say the book is actually a companion to a podcast that I host together with Katie McDaniel, Dr. Katie McDaniel from Marietta College, also here in Ohio, where I am. And together we host it. We've hosted it for several years now. It's gone through some changes, some personal changes and things like that, but we have a great team now, and it's a MuggleNet. MuggleNet is a Harry Potter fan site that's been long established. And so it's a podcast in the MuggleNet family of podcasts. And so we talk with, academics, other college professors about, Harry Potter, especially, you know, so like, you know, we'll talk to somebody who's a literature scholar about, you know, werewolves and vampires and how they fit, you know, into, because there's, you know, there's a context, there's all kinds of other literature about werewolves and vampires. So like, how does Harry Potter fit into that? You know, so we'll have these kind of academic discussions about these children's stories and, you know, hope to kind of bring more listeners into an academic perspective and also help to bring academics into a more, you know, general audience perspective and relate their ideas to a more general audience. So it kind of flows both ways. So the book came out of the podcast, and we had a publisher approach us and say, "Hey, your podcast would make a great book." And so we pursued that. And it was fun because we had talked to so many academics that it was clear that the book had to be a collection of essays by these various people. And so we had kind of our favorites. We even had a couple of people who hadn't been on the show yet, but we really wanted to have on the show. And so we said, "Hey, what if you wrote about this topic?" Or, "Hey, what if you wrote about that topic?" And gave them some freedom in what they decided to write about. And then we were the editors for the collection. And so when people gave us their essays, we kind of, you know, would tweak here or ask a question there, and then it's kind of cool because after we paired the essays together, two essays that seem to kind of speak to each other in some way, and like my chapter is all about Christmas in Harry Potter and the deeper meanings of Christmas, and of course those are very Christian meanings of Christmas in Harry Potter. And then the other chapter that I'm paired with is about the mythical beasts that are in the series, that are in the series and are in the Fantastic Beasts series. And so then we recorded a podcast kind of discussing our chapters, and then we record it. We put like a little part of a transcript of that into the book itself. So it really is a podcast as a book. So it's kind of cool that way. So did you want to know about like how I got into talking about Harry Potter in general and in this very nerdy academic way?
Yeah, that's a good point to discuss right there.
Okay. So now that we have the book contextualized, I first read it, my friend Kukwa, whose birthday it is today, at least when we're recording, she gave me the first three books. We were in grad school together at University of Dayton. And she said, our first semester was pretty brutal in terms of all the reading, and none of us were used to it. So we were like, brain dead after the end of the semester. And it was like nearing Christmas. And she said, read these three books. You will like them. It'll be like a break for your brain. And it was, but at the same time, I really enjoyed them. Really, that's kind of all it was. But then as the books continued to go on, I realized how much these stories were about the Christian mystery. And that's everything that interested me theologically in terms of the celebration of the liturgy, which is a celebration of the Christian mystery. Every single time, you know, we gather for Mass, we're celebrating, we're entering into the Paschal mystery of Christ. And this book really, really took this mythic story and laid it on a specific person, you know, especially Harry, a very relatable young man who we could kind of walk around in the footsteps of. And so these books kind of invite us into the same story. All the symbolism, I love medieval stuff, you know, and there's tons of medievalism in the books. I've always been a big Arthurian legend fan. I've been a big Shakespeare fan. There's so many elements of all that in the books that they were kind of naturally attracting me. And so as the series kind of kept unfurling, you know, and these new books came out until it was complete at the seventh book, I kept becoming increasingly interested in the way that it illustrates the Christian mystery. And so I began to use it in my teaching. I was teaching theology classes at the University of Dayton, and I began to use it, you know, as analogous to, you know, things, you know, when we're talking about relativism, well, what is relativism? Well, let's talk about it, okay, in terms of Harry Potter, like, you know, so, and students were like, oh yeah, now I get it, you know? And so that really kind of fanned the flame of my interest as well, because it was just useful. It eventually led, I was a listener of these podcasts about Harry Potter. I'm an early adopter of podcasts. I was actually creating podcasts in like 2009, and listening to them even earlier than that. And so I was listening to these podcasts, and I was kind of shouting at the podcast, like, you know, I really needed to be on the podcast. So eventually I did. I ended up writing a paper about the symbolic nature of the sport in the Wizarding World, Quidditch, and how it's really not meant to be taken so much as a sport as a system of symbols that tell us, you know, something about the narrative. And it got published, and then I got invited onto one of these podcasts, and I was in the door, I had a toe in the door, so I just kind of crammed my foot and the rest of me all the way in.
Okay, that's a really good, fascinating backstory of how you got acquainted with Harry Potter and how the book came into fruition. So that's really good to know. So again, another like backstory, preface to question. By Star Trek and Star Wars. Bigger fan of Star Wars. I've seen all the films. Definitely think Episode 3 is my favorite of the films.
Oh, good choice. Good choice. Yeah,
Episode 3.
Revenge of the Sith.
Right.
Yes. Okay. Best. Really good choice.
Not so much Star Trek. I've seen the J.J. Abrams series of like the last 15 years or so.
Yeah,
and I've seen some of the 60s episodes, which were really fascinating and groundbreaking mm-hmm. for its time. But I haven't seen anything in between that with the Wrath of Khan and all that. So I have a basic understanding of Star Trek, but a more deeper understanding-ish of like Star Wars. But I know you are like super passionate about both of the like cultural, historical franchises that have played such a monumental like force in our culture. So for those of us who have like a real basic understanding of these two powerhouse franchises. What are we missing for us to go a little deeper on, like, the political, metaphysical, philosophical dimensions that they offer?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I will say I definitely recommend Wrath of Khan to you. I'm sitting here wearing, and maybe your listeners will understand, I'm wearing a Botany Bay t-shirt right now.
That's
USS
on the
Botany Bay.
film.
It's from the film. Yes,
Okay.
that's from the film and from, because there's an episode of the original series that the Wrath of Khan, is an extrapolation of, and so it's all delightful stuff. That is definitely my favorite Trek movie.
I'm gonna break that down as something to watch, hopefully this weekend, right at the con. I've been
Yeah.
sleeping on it for 20 years.
Well, and before you do, watch the episode, the original series, and I don't know what season it is. There's only a couple seasons of the original series, but it's called Space Seed. Space
Okay,
Seed,
I'm
right?
writing it
So
down.
watch that first and then go and watch Wrath of Khan. And Ricardo Montalban is just so
From Fantasy
fabulously
Island.
fabulous. Yeah, from Fantasy Island, which was
Yeah.
it's funny because my parents didn't really like any kind of fantasy or science fiction. They're not into that type of stuff at all. They love to read, love to watch great stuff, but they didn't. They just it was all a little too weird for them,
Right.
but they watched Fantasy Island, and so I knew about Ricardo Montalban. So anyway, so I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan. So I think that part of my attraction, I would say my initial attraction to both Star Trek and Star Wars, and I will say that besides, like you, seeing some of the original episodes in syndication as a kid, probably supposed to be doing my homework, but I'm watching this thing about the tribbles, and I had that experience as well. Star Wars, not as much. Like maybe saw one or two of the movies in the theater, but went headlong, face first into the whole franchise in 2015, through some graduate courses actually that I was able to take online. I had taken a Harry Potter course, and I took and it ended up taking the Star Wars course, thinking, well, I'll just join this conversation, So I like to be part of the conversation when so many people are passionate about Star Wars, so many people are passionate about Star Trek. I like to be able to hang with that conversation that's going on and know what they're talking about. And because I tend to be friends with nerdy people anyway, so I might as well know what they're talking about. So, but as I learned about those franchises, and as they both have become more important to me. I realize that, in their history is the answer to why they fascinate me so much. Gene Roddenberry, he wanted to make cop shows, because I think he had been a cop. He wanted to make cop shows, and he wanted to deal head on with race. And this was in the mid 1960s. He wanted to deal with race in these shows, and the studio said, absolutely not. We're not going to do that. We're not going there. We're here to entertain. We're not here to moralize. Well, he was not satisfied with that. And so he started casting stories in a futuristic, milieu where he didn't have to deal with race so much. He could deal with the exact issues through like alien species, And so he could make the focus something that the viewer has to then it's kind of disarming, right? So you're not threatened by this conversation because it's about alien species. Like, that's not even in our vocabulary, but it forces you to consider the same issues that you can then apply into real life, and have more empathy for people who are different from you. And so it's really quite progressive. And the earliest show was quite progressive even in its casting. I mean, in some ways it was very much of its time. But if you think about Nichelle Nichols and her involvement in the show, and how people like Mae Jemison have said that because they saw Nichelle Nichols in this show, she thought, girls can be in space. Girls ought to be in space, and that this was like a personal inspiration for her. So it's a really kind of progressive show that I love what it has to say about its very aspirational view of humanity, like this is what we could be, if we could all kind of work together. So that's really neat. So on the flip side with Star Wars, there's a really different concern that inspired George Lucas, but his concern is even more up my alley, and that's why I always say Star Wars is my my first love, and Star Trek and Harry Potter are there too, but Star Wars is definitely my first love. He wanted to give young people an experience of myth in the religious sense of the term. And he wanted people to be able to encounter the transcendent realm, which is a very lofty goal, for a filmmaker. And but that's exactly what Star Wars does. And it gives people this ability to experience that without all the baggage of established religions, which, by the 1970s have gotten some difficult, I mean, people are straying, this is the beginning of people straying away in great numbers from religion. So there's something about these films that capture the awe and the transcendent experience that we as humans long for, but maybe that we can't, for some reason, satisfy through religion. And so what I see it as is a way to kind of circle back into those traditions and to see these transcendent experiences are available to you. I think of that every time, at my church, they ring the bells during the consecration, right? And so we're kind of old school that way, but they ring the bells, and I always think, it's that magic moment. It's that magic moment. And I know we're probably not supposed to think of it like that. Six theologians just shifted uncomfortably in their seats when I said that, but it is a magic moment. And I think it's okay for us to embrace that. That magic happens every, could happen every day in my world if I could get myself to daily mass, but it is magical what we celebrate in our Catholicism. And so that's why I love to enjoy those Star Wars stories that really kind of encourage us to look for the magic in everyday existence.
That's a good point. The last part you just said, looking for magic in everyday life, on everyday existence, is something definitely good. And I definitely see how you said how George Lucas wanted to incorporate elements of religion in like a low-key-ish way so people can understand. And you see that a lot in Star Wars with like the religious order, the idea of the Force, the good versus evil, imperfect savior sort of thing. So that's a good point that I never knew about George Lucas.
Well, and the other thing about both Trek and Star Wars is that they depict these political structures that don't exist in our world but could, or did exist and don't anymore, for good reason or for bad reason. And they really challenge us to consider such political structures. They challenge us to consider the nation of, I'm sorry, notions of freedom, human freedom. What does it mean? Where does it end? Where does it begin? Where does it end? What about strong men and tyrants? How do they come to power, right? Star Wars, oh man, Revenge of the Sith. Oh, and Attack of the Clones too. Everybody makes fun of Attack of the Clones. This is one of my favorite Star Wars movies because it has, first of all, so much Obi-Wan Kenobi, and secondly, because it he's right behind me. It because it lays this groundwork for how the Emperor seized power and granted himself these emergency, powers, and began to dispose of his enemies and those who would stand against him. And I think the prequels are getting, which were, in the when they were first released, people were like, this isn't Star Wars, this is boring political stuff. Now we're starting to see how relevant they are when our democracy is largely viewed to be backsliding, into something else, So how does this happen? How does the Republic fall? How does the Republic turn into an empire? And is this going to happen to us? And how do we prevent it? If we're on that path too, how do we prevent it? So Star Trek and Star Wars are very, very helpful as laboratories of working these ideas out in a safe space. And whether they're religious, whether they're stuff about, racial justice or socioeconomic justice, whether they're political notions, it's a safe space to work them out. And I think, it's entertaining as well.
Yeah,
Bonus.
if you say what you're saying is true, then the resurgence of the sequels is a good thing. I definitely think the sequels deserve their flowers. So that's a good thing. And I think we need to elevate them and like really analyze what the implications of the messages, like you said, about the troubles of democracy now and how that played out in the second film. That's a good little like comparison right there.
Yeah.
So my last question, I have a secret question I'm gonna ask afterwards
Okay.
that I didn't prepare you for. Who is your favorite saint in the Catholic Church? I know it's a silly question to ask because it's like a kid in a candy shop and you have a zillion saints, but if you could just pick one or so, who would you
One
like?
or so. I have had it, I kind of was thinking about this one in advance. I love Saint Nicholas because he reminds me of my dad. My dad was a big generosity guy. He was secret generosity. My dad was always slipping you the 20, or slipping, he would, before he would go to a big city for like a trip or whatever, he would put 10 ones in his pocket and he would give one to every single homeless person that came up to him. Every single one. He would just hand them out. No questions asked. Here you go. So Saint Nick reminds me of that, and I like that. I love Saints Perpetua and Felicity. They're just kind of like badass women that are badass women for Christ, and I love that. I've always identified with Saint Augustine and even with his mother Monica, but I would say my favorite is Blessed Franz Jägerstätter, who a lot of people don't know about. He's a new he was became blessed, I think, in maybe 2007, and he was an Austrian peasant who was drafted into the Nazi into military service for the Nazis when the Germans took over Austria. And he was a farmer with a wife and three small girls, and he was his church's sexton, which means he was like a cross between a sacristan and a like sacristan and like a groundskeeper, and he refused to serve do his military service with the Nazis. And everybody thought he was crazy. His bishop advised him that he should just comply with the Nazis. Everybody thought he was going to be killed, and he was killed. And he wrote beautiful letters to his wife and children from the prison that he was kept in, encouraging them to safeguard their souls over, as their most precious object. And he was just a really brave person. And years later, even the people in his small village even didn't still didn't understand his choice, still didn't, they still said, why would you do this? Why, what if everybody behaved like that? One woman said, what if everybody behaved like him? Yes, indeed. What if everybody refused to serve the Nazis? Yeah, what if? And so it's funny, I love the fact that none of this is on his gravestone. The only thing on his gravestone is his name, his dates, and the fact that he was the church sexton. And that always inspires me about, the ministry that we do in our parishes and how it really forms us and shapes us and help strengthens us to do the hard things that we have to do in life.
Wow, definitely a saint to research. I mean, obviously, I've never heard of him just because the church is like a kid at a candy store when it comes to saints.
Exactly.
But
Yeah,
definitely
no.
somebody to research.
And I'll recommend a book about him. It's by Gordon Zahn, and it's called In Solitary Witness. And it's just a fabulous book. And it contains so many of his letters to his wife. And they're just, I mean, he's kind of old school, kind of crusty in his Catholicism, but he was a young man. He was wild as a young man. He kind of, in fact, I think he had a child with a woman before he got married, but he married this Catholic woman I mean, they were a very strong Catholic pair. There's even a new film about him that was released just a few years ago about him and his wife and their kind of their love story. And that is also a beautiful film. I cannot remember what that's called. But so there's been more interest in him. I have a picture from his beatification. His wife was present at his beatification. I mean, and her face is just radiant. Like, you married well. When you attend your
The
husband's
beatification.
beatification, it's just like, when does that happen? It's just such a beautiful story.
That is a beautiful story, and surprised to hear that the wife was still alive like 70, 60 years later.
Oh, she was like 97, and she has died within the last few years. But Francisca, her name was Francisca, and yeah, beautiful family. Such a cool story.
Definitely some information to go back and look for that I wrote down, and other people should go research too. So my last question, you mentioned the illustrious, James Taylor, Carly Simon, James Br Jackson Brown, and all those really great singer-songwriters from the 70s and whatnot. This is not limited to the 70s, but what's the album that you listen to from start to finish that you can listen to start and finish repeatedly that's timeless?
JT by James Taylor.
Okay.
That was a fast answer, wasn't
Yeah, that's
it?
fast.
Yeah, that's my favorite. That's my favorite. And it's just so many good songs. In fact, it's been a while since I've listened to it. And I just got a I got a external CD DVD drive. I haven't had access to CDs for a long time because, you know, they don't put them in the MacBooks anymore. And my old one died. I got a new one a couple years ago, and I haven't had, so I haven't, we don't have one in the house anymore. They all broke, you know. So now you're going to make me go and get my old CDs out and upload JT to my computer so I can just sit here in my office and listen to it. It's like therapy. I mean, it's just such a beautiful album. Just the instrumentation and the songs, and he's so philosophical with his lyrics. You know, he's sitting around thinking about the meaning of life, and he's writing songs about it, and I liked his version of the meaning of
Right.
life. Yeah, I'll take it. I'll take it. So, and just some about his voice. He definitely taught me to sing. So I love to sing along with that one.
Oh yeah, definitely. Fire and Rain is like real, deep and theological.
Yeah, and autobiographical too. And I always wrote autobiographical songs. I couldn't not write autobiographical songs. And so I appreciate that, you know, that willingness to be vulnerable. It's a struggle, you know, it's a difficult thing to do to, you know, people often say, why don't you perform anymore? And I'm like, well, let me think about it. So I got a little tired of going out into clubs and opening up my personal, you know, journal and basically singing out the contents of it for strangers.
Right, right.
Sometimes not strangers, sometimes people I knew who would then ask me questions about it afterwards. You know, I mean, so it's a little of a vulnerable activity. But I admire those who can do it all their lives and you know, really be honest in their music.
That's a wonderful answer. Definitely encouraged me to go back and listen to more James Taylor. I know him. I think he's a great singer-songwriter, but definitely take a deeper dive in.
Yeah, highly recommended.
Okay. Well, I definitely appreciate your time, and you provide like a wealth of knowledge on, some of these monumental cultural franchises over the last 60 years, and plus going into your singer-songwriter career, which is really fascinating and eye-opening to hear. I think the work that you do is really great, and I appreciate you taking out the time this morning to partake and share your story and your faith journey. I know it's a vulnerable, hope probably opened up some space, but I'm glad you came and shared in this space. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation, Everett, and I admire the work you do as well, so I hope you keep on doing it.
Yep, for sure. And you guys can continue to peep the podcast that she started with her and Eric, Meet Rivers podcast, still a groundbreaking instrument in the Catholic Church that details the life of Father Clarence Rivers and provides so much intimate and personal knowledge and wisdom and insights that they've compiled along with so many popular guests from the church who knew him that are here with us today. So definitely peep that podcast, and you guys can tune in to the next episode.